Hello, and welcome to this episode of Felonious, a podcast where we discuss the realm of true crime, from chilling cold cases to the wild and wacky. We'll explore it all with a perfect blend of seriousness and humour. My name is Emma.
And I'm Nazia. To keep up to date with what's coming up, be sure to follow us on Instagram at felonious.pod and visit our website feloniouspod.com. We hope you enjoy this episode, so let's get to it. Shall we crack on?
Yeah.
I have to remind myself what I've found for this week. Right, woman arrested after police found $2,500 worth of Stanley Cups in her car.
I didn't really know what a Stanley Cup was when you sent this to me. I thought, is that a trophy?
I only know what it is, I think because of mainly Instagram, probably TikTok, now that I'm using TikTok. But yeah, I think it's from what I understand, in America, there's the latest craze of Stanley Cups. And I remember vaguely, not long ago, they became popular because someone's car, I think it was their car, caught on fire, and the only thing that survived intact was the Stanley Cup.
Okay.
I think I might be wrong, but that's my memory. And all the influencers are parading around with their Stanley Cups. It's just another capitalist, like, pay money for a container for liquids.
Mm.
While it's fashionable, and then it's just going to end up in landfill at some point. But in this case, in this woman's car, she had about 2,000. I want to know how much they cost, because there's a picture and there's not that many.
They said there's 65 of them worth almost $2,500.
Wow. I'm just, because I can't do the maths. I want to Google.
Yeah, I can't do the maths.
How much is a Stanley Cup? Because I'm not, my arithmetic isn't great at the best of times. What? The highest price is $111.
Well, if there's 65 of these and they're $2,500 altogether, then it'd be like $40 each, wouldn't it? Something like that.
Okay, some of them are about 60. I'm just looking at the first Google line is telling me. But I think the average price is about $60, maybe.
That's insane.
It's just to hold water, well, drink, you know, I guess it insulates. But you can buy, look, most people in general already have a thermos or water cup or even those steel bottles.
Mm.
And I guess, you know, the Stanley Cup is just because it's popular, because it's all over social media. Yeah, and they come out with like their limited edition ones, I guess. But they're so big. It's so impractical.
She was quite brazen in the way that she did it.
She
had a shopping cart full of them, and she just left the store without paying and refused to stop for the staff who were trying to get hold of her. And she just stuffed them all in her car and drove off.
I mean, yeah, that is pretty brazen. What did she think was going to happen?
No idea. Like, what would she do with all of those? I mean,
sell them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, that's quite a lot of money.
But anyway, she was arrested and accused of grand theft.
Right. God, people are silly, aren't they? You found something related to Stanley Cup as well, haven't you?
Yes, I have. It is actually about the Stanley Cups. And it's about the maker of the cups that they've been sued because apparently they contain lead.
All right.
And for obvious reasons, they didn't make this known to the public.
And all the influencers are flashing their Stanley Cups.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if there will be any more after this, but four women have taken them to court and sued them because of the cups containing lead.
Doesn't surprise me.
No, it's the lead is in the actual vacuum seal. I don't understand why it needs to have lead in.
Yeah, well, even more things to end up in landfill.
Yeah.
Hooray!
And pollute the planet even more.
Yeah. I mean, especially if it's true that they can withstand fire, like how long?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of when you said that. I was like, yeah, there's probably a reason for that.
Yeah, when the earth burns, that'll be the only thing left. That yeah, and cockroaches. Yeah. Don't buy a Stanley Cup. I hope they don't make it across the oceans and start selling in Europe and whatnot.
I hope not. I genuinely thought that they had done something to do with, like, American football. Because it's, yeah, it's like the Super Bowl season.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say Super Bowl.
Why?
Because it's a trademark name.
But if we can say it, can't we?
Chris told me something about it. I don't know, I'm just going to say it. If I get in trouble, I get in trouble.
I don't think you'll get in trouble.
I'm always paranoid about getting in trouble on this show.
It's fine, we're not going to get in trouble. I'll probably get in trouble for calling my cats dickheads on it. It's because they are. Well, Lockie is.
You'll have the French equivalent to the RSPCA on your, yeah, your door.
Exactly. Verbally abusing my animals.
Speaking about animals, the next find.
Oh, yeah. So, Indian police clear a suspected Chinese spy pigeon after 8 months in bird lockup. So, in New Delhi, Indian police in May 2023, yes, that we're in 24 now, gosh. So in May 2023, it was captured near a port in Mumbai with two rings tied to its legs, and it was carrying words that looked Chinese. The police suspected that it was involved in espionage and took it in. But yeah, it was sent to an animal hospital. However, it turned out the pigeon was an open water racing bird from Taiwan that had escaped and made its way to India. And then the bird was transferred to the Bombay Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, and it's recently been set free. And in 2020, in Kashmir, a pigeon was released belonging to a Pakistani fisherman after a probe found that the bird, which had flown across the heavily militarized border between the nuclear-armed nations, was not a spy. And before that, in 2016, another pigeon was taken into custody. Have they actually ever found a pigeon that's been accused of, that has actually been used for espionage?
Well, what have they got against pigeons?
People, just stop using pigeons for anything. Let them be. I know they get a bad rep. They're like, people call them rats with wings or whatever. But, like, just leave them alone.
Do you know that they're in every continent apart from
the really cold ones?
Yeah.
Oh, that makes sense. It's going to be parakeets next, because they're the new pigeons, aren't they? You see them everywhere now.
We used to hear them when I lived in Chiswick, because there was a big group of them in Richmond Park.
Yeah, they're all over London now.
But they make one heck of a noise when there's a flock of them.
Was it last year? I was walking around the field not far from my home, and there's a chateau with a bit of like woodlands, and Alex and I, we saw a group of parakeets terrorizing a red squirrel. Like, they were literally bullying this squirrel. The squirrel was just running away and being chased by a bunch of parakeets.
Just keeping an eye on your cat.
It's okay, he's on the sofa. He's just trying to look for trouble.
He heard us talking about parakeets and thought he might as well get involved.
But yeah, there was a red squirrel being bullied by a bunch of parakeets. I felt really sorry for the red squirrel, because you don't see many red squirrels.
No, they're very timid. So we have them here and you hardly ever see them.
But yeah, these parakeets were just being a bunch of dickheads and bullying this squirrel. Next, they're going to be used for spy, for espionage, apparently, maybe.
Oh. Maybe the Russians will want them. Who knows?
Yeah. Right, moving on.
Yeah, on today's episode, we're going to discuss Alphonse Bataillon, who contributed to the advancement of forensic science in France in the 19th century and developed a number of advanced techniques for identifying criminals, most notably within criminal photography, and is known as the father of the mugshot. He's a pretty interesting guy.
Yeah.
And in this episode, there's not too much heavy stuff in this one, apart from mentions of racism and theft.
Yeah, and quite interestingly about the prison colonies, which I never knew about until this case.
Mm, same here.
Yeah.
So there's lots of interesting things in this one.
Yeah. So Alphonse Bataillon was born in 1853 and was the son of Louis Bataillon, a physician and one of the founders of the School of Anthropology in Paris and the chief of the Bureau of Statistics. So he enjoyed measuring humans and created charts, of which some are very racist, making assumptions about race and behaviour. Alphonse's brother, Jacques, helped set up the International Statistics Institute, and Alphonse, who was the black sheep of the family, didn't do well in school and left without any qualifications. At the age of 20, however, he managed to pass a bachelor's degree in science and literature. His father found him a job as a junior bank clerk, but this didn't last long. His father then sent him to Great Britain, where he drifted through a number of jobs before returning to France. He was conscripted into the French army in 1875 due to the Franco-Prussian War, but in 1879, he was discharged and got a clerical job at the Prefecture of Police in Paris. When he started his job, he found that all the criminal records were in disarray and the rates of reoffending were increasing in Paris, but there was no effort put in by the police force to stop reoffenders. The police were taking records of criminals, but only recording minor details and general descriptions. So Alphonse decided to do something about it. He started a cataloguing process, and by using some tools he had invented, devised a system of measuring distinguishing features such as height, length of the torso, length and width of the head, skin and eye colour, and even the protrusion of the eyeball. These measurements were put on individual index cards alongside other identifying features, like scars, tattoos, and with photographs of the criminal. The index cards were not ordered alphabetically, but by head measurements of small, medium, and large.
The tool for like measuring the protrusion of the eyeball.
Yeah.
Ugh.
I haven't seen it. I'm going to... Maybe I have and I can't remember it. I'm not going to Google it now.
I get really weird about eyeballs.
I suppose it's for very specific detail to measure.
Yeah. But I guess it's just like a bit like phrenology, like... The bumps on the head mean that you're a particular type of criminal. Maybe that meant the same thing. Who knows?
Yeah. Who knows? And it is within photography that his enduring legacy was established. Mugshots had been around for a few years. Photographing criminals began in the 1840s, not long after the invention of the medium. But in 1888, Alphonse standardised the way these pictures were taken by photographing the criminals facing the camera and in profile, as he believed ear size and shape to be important identifiers. He even took a mugshot of his two-year-old nephew Francois as a joke after he had eaten all the pears from a basket, and it is quite cute. It's funny that it took that long for them to standardise the way they photograph criminals. And make notes of what you would think would make sense.
Yeah, because they weren't even... I don't think they were even taking, like, full names at one point.
Yeah.
And so people would get arrested and then just give fake names for the...
Yeah.
Like, if they repeatedly got arrested.
It's bizarre. But, I mean, they got there in the end.
I mean, what were they doing before they took notes?
I don't know. obviously not taking it very seriously.
No.
So he also standardized the way in which the subject should be lit and how they should be posed. He not only took photographs of criminals after being arrested, but he took photographic evidence of crime scenes too, paving the way for today's crime scene photographic processes. He had a photography lab set up at the Paris police station so he could develop these images and take mugshots at the same time.
Alphonse also developed metric photography, where he used grids to help record the dimension of a crime scene and the evidence or objects in it, so that it could be easily replicated by police if needed. He also developed a new way of taking photographs of the victim at crime scenes by placing a camera with a wide-angle lens on a high tripod, which he invented, that was positioned over the victim's body. A god's eye view, as it came to be known. It allowed for the crime scene to be photographed without contaminating it. Alphonse's assistant, Rodolphe Archibald Rice, perfected this practice and even photographed close-ups of the victim's clothing, wounds, identifying features, and fingerprints. He is credited by some as the pioneer of macro photography. Alphonse's new system of identifying repeat offenders was ridiculed at first by the people he worked with. They thought he was too eccentric and he didn't really make any friends at work. His boss then retired and his replacement became interested in Bataillon's system. The new boss gave him 3 months to prove that his system could work, and it did. In 1884, his system helped identify 241 repeat offenders. As his database grew, he had some great successes.
I wonder that he didn't have friends, probably because they had to actually do their jobs properly for once.
Have they ever done their job properly?
Yeah, that's true.
French society was in fear of bomb plots devised by anarchists at the time. Bataillon was able to catch one of the most famous ones, who was named Ravachol. Ravachol had planted 2 bombs in the city centre, which exploded and caused great panic. Ravachol was tried, convicted, and sentenced to death by guillotine. Bataillon received the Legion of Honour for his work in catching him. Another interesting case was that of a swindler named Simon. He was pronounced dead after escaping a penal colony in Cayenne in South America. He and a friend had used a canoe, and it was just assumed that they never made it out alive, as a body had been found on the coast with very bad head injuries and it was wearing Simon's clothes. A few years later in Paris, there was talk of a well-to-do financier named Vernet. The head of the Paris police believed that Vernet was actually Simon, and so the police sought out a plan to get Vernet's measurements to prove their theories. The police, unbeknownst to Vernet, arranged a societal event, one they knew Vernet would attend. As part of the entertainment, they got Bataillon to perform his measurements on members of the audience. Vernet tried to avoid being picked, but the audience encouraged him onto the stage. And surprise, surprise, the measurements matched. Vernet was Simon. After being arrested, he hung himself in his cell as he did not want to be returned to Cayenne.
Yeah, so this is where I started looking into like these colonies. So the penal colonies, they were notorious prison systems at the time. And the exiled prisoners there would include political prisoners, thieves and murderers. And the mortality rate was really high, due to inmate-on-inmate violence, as well as tropical disease. And very few survivors or escapees ever made it back to France. So no wonder someone like Simon, he preferred to hang himself than go back, especially if he's managed to make that one hell of a journey from South America back to France.
Yeah, and become a socialite.
Yeah, it's like, fuck that, I'm not going back there again.
Yeah,
you know.
What a change in lifestyle.
Yeah, yeah.
The Bataillonage system was adopted by other Paris police departments, as well as others in Europe, and in New York and Chicago in the US. Bataillon became so famous that he is mentioned in the book The Hounds of the Baskervilles by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, where a character compares Sherlock Holmes as being second to Bertillon. Alphonse also made contributions to the field of ballistics, implemented galvanoplastic compounds to preserve footprints, and constructed the dynamometer to measure the degree of force used in breaking and entering. In 1888, he was made the director of the new Bureau of Identification. The French government decided that all French vagrants and those who are homeless should carry a card with their bataillon measurements on it in order to identify them. Although the bataillonnage system was adopted in other countries, police departments found it difficult to implement as the tools had to be recalibrated all of the time. The calipers used would also give different measurements for the same person, and a trained technician could only use them to take accurate measurements. It also wasn't reliable when looking at juvenile offenders or people who would dramatically change their appearance, and there were too many people with similar measurements. Alphonse absolutely hated receiving criticism about his cherished system and was very arrogant and would insist that the critic was the one in the wrong. By 1907, his system was superseded by fingerprinting and handwriting analysis, which Alphonse was a great critic of. He said that handwriting held no value for identification, as it lacked any distinct features specific to an individual. And he was apparently good friends with Sir Francis Galton, who was a big supporter of fingerprinting and influenced the police force into using it. And I found an article or research paper written by Richard Fairbrother and Julian Champkin. And there's a quote in here about Alphonse. And it is, "But when the Argentine detective Juan Vucicic, who had pioneered the use in practice, that is fingerprinting, came to Paris to visit him, Bertillon kept him waiting for hours outside, then finally opened the office door and shouted, 'You have done me incalculable harm,' and slammed the door in his face."
Lovely.
Sounds like a great guy.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
However, in 1894 and 1899, Alphonse Bertillon was a witness for the prosecution as a handwriting expert in the Dreyfus affair. This was a scandal involving 35-year-old Captain Alfred Dreyfus, an artillery officer of Jewish descent. He was convicted of treason and accused of passing information about the French military onto the Germans. Alphonse Bertillon claimed that Alfred Dreyfus had written the document known as Bordereau. Did I say that right?
Bordereau.
Bertillon said that the handwriting in the document was made to look like a forgery, but that it was Dreyfus that did that with the help of a grid. So he believed that Dreyfus sort of traced over his own handwriting to make it look like someone had forged it. Dreyfus was sentenced to life and sent to a penal colony on Devil's Island in French Guiana. In 1896, evidence came to light that it was actually a French army major, Ferdinand Walsin Esterhazy, who was the spy for the German Empire, and that it was his handwriting in the document. This was uncovered by Georges Picquart, the head of the army's intelligence unit, but those in higher ranks in the French military suppressed the evidence and Esterhazy was acquitted. In 1898, the writer Émile Zola had an open letter titled J'accuse, published in the socialist newspaper
L'Aurore.
Thanks, Nazia.
Sorry.
In it, Émile accused the military of a major cover-up and defended Alfred Dreyfus and called for the government to reopen his case. Dreyfus spent 5 years imprisoned in very harsh conditions until 1899, when he was returned to France for his second trial. Again, Bertillon appeared at the trial and professed that Dreyfus was guilty, despite three other handwriting experts saying otherwise. This scandal divided the French nation between those who supported Dreyfus and those who believed he was guilty, and most of them were anti-Semitic, like Alphonse. At the end of his second trial, he was still found guilty and received a 10-year sentence, but he was pardoned and released. In 1906, he was exonerated and reinstated as a major in the army. The Dreyfus affair had an impact on Bertillon's family as his brother was married to a Jewish chemist, so they fell out and didn't speak for years. It was during the trial when Bertillon was giving his evidence that the President of the Republic described him as a madman and that he seemed to have escaped from an asylum. And there's an English journalist who wrote this about Bertillon. Now and again, Mr. Bertillon's voice rose in hateful shrieks. There were interludes when he clenched his fist and struck the bar, swearing that Dreyfus was the traitor. The voice rang out with passion and excitement. You beheld it in him, the man vain unto madness, with confidence in his atrocious fantasies. He was at last taking his revenge for all the insults of those who had called him a fit subject for an asylum of the insane. That was written at the time of the trial.
Sounds like a right character.
Yeah, it gets crazier from here.
In 1911, Alphonse Bertillon was put on the case of the stolen Mona Lisa. Da Vinci's painting was hanging in the Louvre when someone took it from the wall and walked out with it. There was no security around the painting like there is today, whereas today the painting is set into concrete behind two panes of bulletproof glass and has 24-hour security. 30 hours had passed before the theft was reported. People accused the French government of staging the theft to distract people from the threat of war. There was a huge reward put up and thousands of tip-offs and theories by the public were sent to the police. Alphonse, although still a critic of fingerprinting, took the prints of the 257 employees working at the gallery on the day of the theft. A security guard found the wooden frame of the painting on some stairs, and it held one thumbprint. It turned out to be a left thumbprint, and Alphonse's fingerprint collection only contained right thumbprints. He also had too many prints in his archive to look through, about 750,000. Which is why he took the fingerprints of the gallery employees.
For someone against fingerprinting so much, he had a lot on file.
Yeah. Yeah, but he only did the right hand, so.
Yeah.
Picasso and his friend Apollinaire, who was the creator of Cubism, were even suspects. Apollinaire did admit to stealing some figurines as a prank in the past. At the time, Picasso and his friends were considered troublemakers and would often walk the streets of Paris drunk and shooting pistols in the air. Picasso and Apollinaire were nearly run out of France. Picasso betrayed his friend when questioned about another art theft. He was asked if he knew Apollinaire, to which he said, "I have never seen him before." 45 years later, Picasso admitted his guilt for betraying his friend. The Mona Lisa was reported as being seen on the Swiss border, on a train to Holland and on a steamer to South America and in an apartment in the Bronx in New York. But it was discovered that the painting was hidden for 2 years in a trunk with a false bottom, hidden under a bed in Paris less than 2 miles from the Louvre. The thief was an Italian named Vincenzo Perugia, who was a house painter, mason and aspiring artist. He had been working at the Louvre to replace some glass around the time the painting went missing. Police interviewed him in his apartment situated 2 miles from the Louvre, and he said that he had been elsewhere on the day of the theft, but the Mona Lisa was hidden in a trunk underneath his bed, underneath the police's noses. In December 1913, Perugia wrote a letter to an antique dealer in Italy. He stupidly believed he would receive a reward for returning the Mona Lisa to its homeland. The antique dealer got in touch with the director of the Uffizi Gallery in Florence and they arranged a meeting with the thief, Perugia, in Milan. The gallery director authenticated the painting and encouraged Perugia in leaving it with them for safekeeping, which he agreed to do. The Italian police were then notified and Perugia was arrested. In court, he said he stole the painting in an act of patriotism and so he got a lenient sentence. On the 5th of June, 1914, he was sentenced to 1 year, 15 days, but he only served 7 months. The Mona Lisa was returned to France in 1917 after a brief tour of Italy. In 1914, Alphonse was nominated to be awarded the Rosette of the Legion of Honour. The condition of the award was that he had to acknowledge his error in the Dreyfus case, but he refused. Alphonse Bertillon died later that same year. Although Bertillon's system of measurements fell out of favour when fingerprint evidence appeared to be more reliable, his system is kind of still used today in the field of facial recognition. Algorithms can be applied to images captured on CCTV to identify wanted individuals, and they work by looking at distances between key points on a face, which is then compared to a database full of other images. The standard he had invented for mugshots is still in use in most countries today. The FBI often use mugshots in their most wanted lists. His system did place people in certain categories, which is very problematic. Along the same lines as phrenology, it could suggest that people with certain measurements were criminals and there were racist sentences given as a result. In Chicago in 1920, the sociologist Ernest Burgess used the Bertillon data and added race as an element in order to build a formula for sentencing and parole decisions. And the Nazis used a very similar system to identify if someone was Jewish or had Jewish ancestry. I actually remember learning about that in school. One of the few things are. Yeah. But Bertillon himself refused that his system does this. He was interviewed in 1894 by the American magazine McClure's, and he said, "I do not feel convinced that it is the lack of symmetry in the visage, or the size of the orbit, or the shape of the jaw, which make a man an evildoer." Going back to fingerprinting, Bertillon said that his measurements were more reliable than fingerprints. But he was proved wrong in 1913 in London when identical twins, Urbanizer Alfred Fox and Alfred Urbanizer Fox, yes, those were their names.
I have mucked up parents.
Yeah, they obviously just couldn't be asked to be imaginative. Fucking hell. Sorry. So, yeah, they were part of Sir Henry Edwards' experiment to see if people could be identified by their fingerprints. Both twins would give alibis for each other. Their Bertillon measurements were the same, surprise, surprise, but their fingerprints told them apart. There was a similar case that happened in America in 1903. A Will West was arrested and measured using the Bertillonage system, and it identified him wrongly as William West, who had been arrested for murder 2 years previously. William West was still serving his sentence at the same prison where Will West was taken to. Wow. Fingerprinting superseded Bertillon's system as they were quicker and easier to obtain than all the body measurements Bertillon stood by. Also, fingerprints are left on surfaces, so it is easy to say whether or not someone had been at the scene of a crime. And even easier now with DNA. But because of Bertillon's stubbornness and arrogance, France became one of the last countries to adopt fingerprinting. Did not know that until this case, by the way.
Yeah, same here. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, but, you know, doesn't surprise me, France being France. It's just typical French behaviour, isn't it? Stubborn.
Yeah, I guess
sorry
so.
To any French listeners.
I can't really comment. I don't live there, so...
No.
So I pulled some famous mugshots from the interwebs.
Yeah.
And I found one of Tim Allen, who in this mugshot kind of looks like Nicolas Cage in Raising Arizona.
I haven't seen that movie in so long.
I haven't seen the movie, but I know the picture. It's just Nicolas Cage with like a moustache and
yeah,
he's holding the plaque with his details on it.
It's a good movie. One of the very few Nicolas Cage movies that I would actually recommend.
Oh, okay. I'll have to give it a watch.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so Buzz Lightyear was arrested for the possession of a lot of cocaine in 1978. The 25-year-old was arrested in Michigan Airport and faced a life sentence because he was carrying 650 grams of coke.
Nice.
And not the drink, the drug.
The powder.
Yeah. He ratted out 21 people he was working with and received a 5-year sentence. He said that comedy saved him while he was in prison.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. The next one that we have is James Brown, the musician, who was arrested in 2004 at the age of 70 for domestic violence against his 33-year-old wife, Tomi Rae Brown. He was arrested multiple times for domestic violence against a number of his wives. In 2004, he pled no contest and paid a $1,000 fine. He looks like, you know, the crazy professor.
From Back to the Future.
Yeah, with his hair going everywhere.
Yeah, he looks like a black version of, I forgot the name of the professor, Back to the Future professor.
People would be screaming if there are any listeners out there. Our last one is Jane Fonda, the actress, who was arrested in 1970 as she was falsely accused of drug smuggling. An officer told her after the arrest that their orders had come from the very top, the US President Nixon. Unbeknownst to her, she was being surveilled by the FBI and CIA because of her anti-Vietnam War stance and activism. Her phone was even tapped. The powerful mugshot inspired thousands of women and men to ask their hairdressers for a hairstyle similar to Jane's. Jane has been arrested 5 times since the 1970s for protesting about climate change. It appears she is proud of her mugshot as she has it appear on items such as mugs and t-shirts on the shop on her website.
Thank you to the authorities for giving her that material to profit from.
it's quite a, you know, it's quite a famous image, isn't it?
Yeah, good for her.
Yeah, but I didn't know, I didn't realise that she was being followed by the FBI and CIA, which was ordered by President Nixon.
Yeah.
That's insane.
What was I going to say about him? I was going to say something unkind about him, but I forgot what I was going to say. He's a bell end. There you go.
That'll do.
Yeah, that'll do. That's all I can come up with right now.
All of them are bell ends apart from Obama.
Yeah. Well, I've got my views on Obama. He still dropped bombs, but anyway.
Yeah,
less said about that, the better. So, yeah.
Yeah, an interesting man was Alphonse Bataillon, who was very stubborn and very racist. It's interesting that his ideas about photography and making notes while you're arresting people still exist today.
Yeah, I mean, for all his faults, which there were many, from the looks of it, he still did something that hadn't been done before, which was like including the crime scene photography, taking down details of people, like physical traits, even though a lot of those physical traits can be changed, especially nowadays. And, you know, he had some involvement in other like crime scene processes.
Mm.
So, yeah, it's just a shame that he was so against fingerprinting, but that's what happens when you have your head so far up your backside.
Yeah, I just found it really funny how he was so against handwriting, how he didn't believe it would be like a great identifier. And yet he was the handwriting expert on the Dreyfus affair.
Yeah, exactly. But disagreeing with the actual handwriting experts. Yeah. That was like three of them. Yeah. And, you know, his mugshots are still taken today. Mm. In this day and age, and there are some great mugshots out there.
Yeah, but a lot of celebrities are having a difficult time, especially if they've, you know, they got arrested in their youth and now they're older, you know, they don't really want that hanging over them.
Apart from Jane Fonda.
Apart from in that case, but a lot of them really don't want them to be online, and because people can buy these photos off of
Public
certain
record,
websites.
Isn't it?
Yeah. So, yeah, I can understand that. But, I mean, don't do the crime in the first place.
It's what happens if you do something, especially if it's a criminal activity, that's the consequence.
But I have read that some people have become famous after their mugshots have gone viral.
Yeah, so there was this guy, he became a model.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can't remember his name, but... like, yeah, everyone was, loads of women were salivating from both ends for this guy.
Yeah, so he gave up his criminal career, so to speak, to...
to become a model. Yeah, I can't remember his name. I don't know if they're still together, but I know he dated the heiress of Topshop briefly.
Okay.
Or at some point. He was connected with her after he got famous and became a model.
I'm just going to look him up now. Jeremy Meeks.
Yeah, that's it.
I knew it was a funny name. Yeah, a former gang member.
Yeah.
And in 2014, he was arrested. And after that, his mugshot went viral and he became a model.
Yeah. And he apparently did. It was Chloe Green. That's the heiress of. I don't know if they're still together or maybe they're not, but he dated her for a bit. So, you know, he's doing all right for himself, considering.
Yeah. Oh, and guess what?
What?
He's born on your birthday.
No shit.
Yeah. Not the same year, but...
Oh, he's a bit older.
Yeah.
He's 40 years old. Wow. We share the same birthday.
Who knew?
It's all right for some, isn't it?
He's got a book out called Model Citizen.
Oh, I wonder who ghostwrote that.
Which is the autobiography of Jeremy Meeks.
Of course.
So yeah, that was Alphonse Bataillon.
Yeah.
C'est la vie.
C'est la vie.
C'est la vie, c'est la vie. Chris is right, I do say things incorrectly.
Well, next episode, I'll be the one saying things incorrectly because we're going to be going into your ends.
Yeah, it's my neck of the woods.
Yeah, you said that correctly. You hear that, Chris?
Yeah. See, I can do it. Yeah, next episode we're going to be discussing Sture Bergwall, or also known as Thomas Quick, who was Sweden's worst serial killer. Or was he?
Yeah, this is most likely going to be more than one part.
Yeah, I think this will be at least a two-parter.
It's a crazy one. Absolutely crazy. And I haven't even finished reading the book yet, whereas you have, so you know what happens till the end.
Yeah,
but
it's an interesting one. But I kind of want to leave it for the episode.
Yeah, no, we won't give away too much.
No.
But yeah, it's going to be quite a head fuck, I think.
Yeah. This guy is well known in Scandinavia, but not so well known outside of the Nordic countries.
No, there's been a documentary done on him, but it was quite a while ago.
Yeah, so join us for that.
Yeah.
You can join us for that on Spotify, Amazon Music and Apple Podcasts. And we're on YouTube as well.
Yes, we are.
Felonious Pod. Search for us on there.
Yeah.
If you like listening to podcasts on YouTube.
Yeah.
See you next Tuesday.
See you next Tuesday. Thank you for listening to the show. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can find more information about the show on our website at feloniouspod.com or on our Instagram at felonious.pod.
Links to our show notes can be found in the episode description, as well as through our website and social media. You can visit our Contact Us page and tell us what you think about the show and if there are any cases you would like us to cover. We hope you join us for the next episode. Goodbye.
Bye.